You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When most of us drop our empty cans and bottles into the recycling bin, we feel like we're doing our part to contribute to a greener planet. Yet how many of us stop to think, where do those bottles and cans actually go? And the answer may surprise you. In Junkyard Planet, travels in the billion-dollar trash trade, Adam Minter, the Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and the son of an American junkyard owner, explores a vast and often hidden industry that's been transforming the global economy and environment. It's published by Bloomsbury Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Adam Minter to our show today. Hello.
Very glad to be here.
You grew up in a family of scrap dealers. How does that affect your opinion of the industry?
Well, I think it sort of biases me, at least to favor some of the activities that occur within it. And at the same time, I think it can make me more critical as well of some of the things that go on and some of the critiques that go on outside of it. But also, as somebody who's lived in China for 11 years reporting on the industry, I think it gives me a sort of a deeper insight into how that industry is developing.
How many generations of your family
My great-grandfather, when he came over from Russia, went into Galveston, Texas and became a rag picker. So that was in the 19-teens.
And those were the kinds of jobs that were left to many Jewish immigrants? Is that why so many Jews wound up in the trade?
Absolutely. At one time, New York City, there's estimates from 1900 saying that well over half of the junk trade in New York City was Jewish. There were a few reasons for that. One, an entrepreneurial culture within the Jewish community. But also, if you're illiterate and you're moving into a new culture, junk is the entrepreneurial opportunity available to you.
Was it assumed that you would go into the family business?
It was sort of implicit. And then over time, as college happened, it was sort of implicit that I really didn't belong there. I don't have a whole lot of business sense.
Well, you're talking about in a Chinese context. So mm-hmm. Is that how it's changed?
In a Chinese context, it was interesting. The business that I grew up in when I was quite young was a very family-oriented business. It was a lot of small-time scrap companies. And as China came onto the scene and started buying up vast amounts of scrap metal in the United States, the industry consolidated, became more professional and sort of less interesting to me.
Is your family business still operating?
On a small scale, yeah.
The word recycling was only coined in the 1920s, but didn't it originally have a slightly different meaning than it does today?
It sure did. It was actually invented by the oil and gas industry to literally describe the recirculation of fuel through the refining process. And that's a recycling of sorts, but it definitely isn't the recycling we think of in our kitchens.
And the recycling that we think of isn't always about scrap metal, but that's what you focus on in this book.
I do focus about 90% on scrap metal. That's true.
You write that the United States is known internationally as the Saudi Arabia of scrap.
Absolutely.
How much scrap metal does the United States produce each year?
In the range, if you include scrap iron, well over 100 million tons.
Wow. You describe the specification and classification system for scrap metal as if it's almost another language.
That's right. If you go into a scrap trading office, you'll hear them talking about buying honey or Zorba or Zurich or Taint and Tabor. And these are all shorthand for specific grades of scrap metal that were invented in the they go back to the 20s to be very convenient to send over telegraph. They wanted 5 and 6 character shorthand for what these things were. So you got these very funny words, and they're still in use.
My guest is Adam Minter. His book, Junkyard Planet, travels in the billion-dollar trash trade. How much of the recycling is still being done in the United States?
Well, right now, about 40% of what the United States puts into its recycling bins, whether that's at home or at a factory complex, about roughly 60% stays here and 40% goes overseas.
And mostly to China? How did China become such a big player in the
scrap
trade?
Right. China is the number one importer. It's not the only one, but it's by far the biggest. The reason China became very big is because they started developing their economy and they needed raw materials to make all the stuff that they export to the world. And scrap metal is and scrap paper and scrap plastics, very good way to get that stuff.
So is it cheaper for the Chinese to import scrap metal from other countries rather than to mine it themselves? They must have some iron ore in their vast country.
Yeah, they definitely do have reserves of non-ferrous metals, nickel, copper, that kind of thing. But it takes a long time to dig a nickel mine. mine costs a lot of money, and it's a very slow process of getting it in. If you really want nickel or copper quickly, buy some American Christmas tree lights.
But are we their major supplier? Are they also getting scrap from other places?
Definitely. I mean, they buy it from all over the developed world. We are the number one supplier, followed by the EU, followed by Japan. And then, interestingly, the ASEAN nations, Malaysia, Vietnam, those areas.
What role does backhaul play in the story?
Very interesting concept that most people aren't aware of. What a backhaul is what you do with a shipping container after it's arrived in, say, Los Angeles with a box of toys made in China. It costs about $2,400 to ship a container from Shenzhen, China, the manufacturing capital of China, to Los Angeles. But the United States doesn't have much to send back to China. So the shipping companies want to get those containers back right away so China can send back more. They discount them. So it costs about $300, one-eighth of what it costs, to send something from China to the U.S. And that's a big incentive then to send metal to China.
So they send us one kind of junk and we send them another kind of junk.
Exactly.
You write that you rarely cite numbers tabulated by environmental organizations when you're talking about these things. Why?
Because they don't know what the numbers are. The most accurate numbers are those that are tabulated by customs organizations and by industry organizations that keep close tabs on what their members do. We tend to think of, as Americans, recycling as an environmental act. But that's a very, very narrow slice of the people who actually engage recycling. Most of the world thinks of it as an economic act, and so that's where the accurate numbers are.
Do you think that the scrap and recycling industries have gotten a bad reputation from environmentalists?
I think they've gotten unfairly portrayed as an environmental negative. So, yes, I do.
Did your family's scrapyard do business with China?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody did. If you have a recycling operation starting right around 1991, 92, in some way or another, you were doing business with China.
So what was the American scrap industry like before China entered the market?
It was a slow growth industry, almost a legacy industry, with a few customers for the scrap metal. You know, if you were in Minneapolis, for example, you knew who your customers were, and you could make a good, steady living, but it wasn't a dynamic marketplace at all.
Has the amount of scrap metal produced here declined because American manufacturing has declined?
That's a very interesting question. Yes, there is actually, when you talk to American scrap traders, they will tell you that there is a scrap shortage. So again, we think of scrap as what we put in our recycling bin, but it's the manufacturing scrap that's so very important.
So what happens now with the backhaul if we don't have as much product to send them?
Well, we still have quite a lot to send them. I mean, there's a scrap shortage, but believe me, you're still talking tens of millions of tons of metal that can go overseas. So from the business standpoint, it's pushing the prices up, but right now it hasn't become a real big macro trend.
Has the rise of China's middle class affected the global recycling business?
It has, absolutely. One thing that's happening is that as they demand more stuff of their own, the price of raw materials rises, the price of everything rises.
But also they're producing their own scrap.
Absolutely.
Are they recycling in China?
Absolutely they are. In fact, you have to remember the largest automobile consumer in the world is the Chinese middle class consumer. The largest PC and mobile phone manufacturer is the Chinese consumer. And all of those goods are going to make their way into the recycling stream.
Well, you live in China. You're the Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview. You've been there how many years?
11 years.
Is household recycling different in China than it is in the United States? Do they have all the different bins?
No. I mean, the way recycling works in China is most people just put it in with their trash, and there are pickers, peddlers, whatever you will call them, will actually go through your trash and pull it out of there. A lot of people are aware of the value, and so say you buy a new television and you have a cardboard box in your apartment, you can literally call to the front gate of your apartment building and ask somebody to send up a recycler who will come with a little hand scale, weigh it, and pay you, you know, the few coins that it's worth. But this concept of putting something in a bin and it being a good deed is foreign. It's an economic activity. If you can make money doing it, you do it. If you can't make money doing it, you let somebody else worry about it.
In this country, we often leave stuff out there and let other people come and just take it. For example, getting deposits on bottles.
Right.
That sort of thing wouldn't happen in China.
No. I mean, certainly if you leave something out, it'll go. But there's no deposit system. It'll just get sold.
You're right that recycling isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card for consumers. What do you mean by that?
Well, many people in this country, and I think in Europe as well, tend to think that when you put that can in your recycling bin, you've sort of achieved expiation for consuming. And you really haven't. All you've done is put off the garbage man for a little while longer. No, nothing can be recycled 100%, and everything disappears eventually. Even metal, an aluminum can, a little bit of that can is lost every time you send it through the recycling system. So what I argue in the book is, I mean, if you really are doing this to preserve the environment, the best thing you can do is reduce and reuse. Recycling is the third worst option on the famous tree.
Reduce and reuse. Well, the reduce part would mean consume less.
Correct.
Well, how do we do that?
Well, and that's something I address.
I mean,
I rarely
purchase canned sodas, for example. But that's a personal decision that has less to do with thinking about recycling and more to do with with my own concerns about my weight and my health.
Sure. Well, I'm the same way. I'd love an iPhone 5 upgrade, and I like to have a new car. I'm the same way. I think it's what I say in the book is it's a broader way of thinking. I don't think we need to think about reducing so much as building better products, reusable products.
Well, in some other countries like Germany, recycling is even more stringent. They have more bins.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of suggesting that something that I always thought was commendable is actually kind of a waste of time?
Not a waste of time. I really think we should be doing it. It's just if you can't reduce your consumption and you can't reuse what you've consumed, then by all means recycle. But certainly don't fool yourself into thinking that you've achieved something.
Well, we have achieved one thing. Everybody knows a positive side of recycling, that every item that's recycled is one less thing put into a landfill.
True. It is.
And that has often had a negative impact on the environment. But are there negative environmental impacts caused by some recycling processes?
Absolutely. And that's a very serious issue, both in the United States but also in China.
Where pollution is such an important thing.
Absolutely.
Is this a polluting industry?
It is. Any raw material industry, whether it's mining or scrapping, recycling, is going to be a polluting industry. And in China, the recycling industry, the paper mills, for example, in China, were responsible for killing off a good portion of the Yellow River in the 1990s. Scrap recycling, there's air pollution components to it, there's ground contamination. It's getting better, but there's a long way to go.
Well, the alternative is more mining and more deforestation.
Exactly. And one of the messages of the book is, all things considered, the worst recycling is still better than the best mining.
My guest is Adam Minter. His book, Junkyard Planet, travels in the billion-dollar trash trade. It's published by Bloomsbury. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Adam Minter, who grew up in a family of scrap dealers in Minneapolis and then became a journalist, now serves as a Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview. He also writes for Atlantic, Foreign Policy, and other publications. And he has written a book called Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade, which is published by Bloomsbury. You first traveled to China as a journalist doing an article on the Chinese scrap industry?
Correct. That was in 2002. And it was supposed to be one article, and it became three articles. And I never basically left.
You convinced your editors that you should stay?
Yeah, it was the right time.
Was it the food?
It was the food. It was the excitement of going out on the street at 6 in the morning and just seeing things humming like they never hummed in Minneapolis. So I stayed.
But as someone who grew up in the scrap industry here in the United States, were you surprised by what you saw in China?
I was astonished by it. I remember the first Chinese scrapyard I went into, it was in Shanghai in Baoshan District. You walk into a warehouse, and it was filled with about 300 women sorting shredded American automobiles by hand. It was absolutely an epic sight, and I still have the photo I took when I walked in there. It really shocked me.
Because it was nothing like what you'd seen in the United States?
It was nothing like I'd seen in the United States, nothing like I'd seen in photos, nothing like I'd seen in newspapers or magazines. It was absolutely unique. And I realized then, frankly, that this was something that I needed to write about. And I knew very early on I'd probably write a book about it as well, just based on that experience.
Listeners have been writing in with questions. I'm not sure you would know the answers to all of these, but let me read them.
Okay.
Emily in Ossining called in and asked, what happens to juice boxes when you try to recycle them? They're sent to China, but they're made of three separate materials, aluminum, plastic, and paper.
Let's see. The juice boxes, I mean, it really depends. I mean, again, you know, only about 40% of our recycling goes overseas. The juice boxes are actually called something – they're called a Tetra Pak, and there is a recycling process for those, and I do believe that they get recycled in the United States, but I can't tell you precisely how.
A listener posted this question on our show page. Can awful ingredients unrelated to metal like iodine – did he say – no, like toxins be recycled into their production processes. I wonder this every time I see the made-in-China metal products that are sold at Home Depot and recall the Chinese sheetrock scandal of a few years ago.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question, and the answer to that is yes. I'm not so much concerned about the metals. What I document in one of the chapters of the book is actually the plastics trade. And the plastics trade, plastics recycling trade in China is notoriously its dirtiest one. And one of the more worrisome aspects of it is that you will have plastics that have no business being recycled into food-grade uses, being turned into food-grade uses, and quite dangerous.
Tom in California asks, is plastic recycling economically sustainable, or does it need subsidies? Are the environmental benefits of plastic recycling worth the costs? And do you not want to place plastics in the landfill?
Well, I mean, it depends on the kind of plastic. You know, there's some plastics that are very economically attractive to recycle, like PET bottles, you know, which you would get like a clear plastic bottle you would have for your Coke. That's done in the United States, and it's a very good business. More difficult to recycle is something like a thin plastic bag you'd get at a supermarket. Those were exported into China, and they were recycled into very cheap plastics there. You simply wouldn't be able to do it here. It'd need to be subsidized. So people need to make those kinds of choices ultimately.
Are they subsidized in China?
Not in China, no.
They could just do it work cheaper.
Exactly.
Kate asked on our show page, if I'm buying soda, which is the best container for recycling, aluminum, plastic, or glass?
You know, that's a hard question for you to answer off the top of my head. But there's actually, if you go to the, there's an organization in Washington, D.C., the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, they will actually tell you the specific material benefits, energy savings, et cetera, that you get from each kind of material in the recycling process. And you can then make your call from that.
Another listener asks, how can we handle the criminal element in scrap metal recycling, especially theft?
Right. Well, I think this is a big subject in the U.S. recycling industry. As the price of stuff goes up, copper, paper, whatever it is, there's more theft of it. There have been a number of programs that have started to restrict the ability of scrapyards to pay cash to people as they bring things in. But ultimately, it's just going to require better enforcement of the laws that we have. And my own personal feeling is that you don't need necessarily more laws on theft of scrap metal. You just need to enforce better the laws that are already on the books.
China is known for the corruption that exists throughout that country, from high-level party officials to local police chiefs. How much corruption do you see in the Chinese scrap industry?
Right. Well, I think the biggest corruption you see is actually within the import trade and the cheating on duties that come in. Nobody likes to pay their taxes, especially Chinese scrap metal importers. And so that's why you see, even though Hong Kong, for example, is a very small city, an enormous percentage of China's scrap metal is actually imported through Hong Kong because the border between Hong Kong and China is notoriously corrupt.
Is it becoming more difficult to report honestly from China? I'm sure you've been following this story about Bloomberg News being accused of quashing a story that alleged financial ties between China's richest man and relatives of top Chinese Communist Party officials because of fears that the government would prevent it from operating mm-hmm. in China.
Well, I can't speak to the Bloomberg issue specifically. I actually work for the opinion side of Bloomberg, so I don't have anything to do with that. But I can say that there have been a number of issues that have occurred over the last couple of years, visa rejections, that have made many of us concerned about our ability to continue working.
And Murdoch has been also accused of softening coverage sometimes to get certain things in China.
Right.
Do you feel that pressure
well,
at all?
I think it's a tough question, but I think a lot of us as reporters there feel the pressure to self-censor. When we see occasionally the Chinese government rejecting visa renewals, all of us sort of second-guess ourselves. And I think that's the much bigger issue than a news organization itself quashing a story. It's what the individual reporter is saying to himself, herself, as he does his work or her work.
Adam Minter is my guest. His book, Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade, published by Bloomsbury Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write that American cars are almost 100% recyclable, but that wasn't the case 50 years ago. What's changed?
What's changed is the technology. 50 years ago, we didn't have the ability to affordably take apart an automobile into its various components, recycle them. Then in the late 1950s, early 1960s, some very smart Texas scrap metal dealers developed the automobile shredder, which basically reduces a car to pieces.
Is that why I don't see these piled-up cars as I used to? In 1969, there were an estimated 70,000 cars and trucks abandoned on the streets of New York City, and then they would wind up in these junkyards just piled on top of each other.
Right, exactly, because it wasn't economical to recycle them, to take them apart, and so people couldn't sell. They would have to pay to have the cars taken in 1969. Well, they didn't. Nobody wants to pay to have their car taken, so they just abandoned it on the street, and technology solved that problem.
What's the scrap metal from old cars made into?
You name the product it's made into. It. A lot of it is made into new cars. So, for example, one of the largest recyclers in the United States does automobile recycling, and they then turn around and sell the aluminum for new car engines.
But there's also paint, and there are other things that also might have toxins in them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And those are the things that sort of get segregated out of the system, or are when the steel makes its way to the steel mill, that stuff will be burnt off in the smelting process, and it'll be captured in whatever environmental protection measures the steel mills have.
You mentioned earlier upgrading for a smartphone. People are constantly doing that. What happens to the old ones that people turn in, the so-called e-waste?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of things happen. One, the first thing that happens is they're evaluated for reuse. So maybe in the United States, somebody doesn't want a third-generation iPhone, but I can guarantee you there are people in Western China who would be thrilled to have one for a very cheap price. So they first go into the reuse and refurbishment market. That's the first one. And that's a thriving market throughout the developing world, and they're filled with phones from the United States. If the phones can't be reused, they're then evaluated for, if they go to Asia, they're evaluated for whether they have within them components that can be reused.
Because there are rare metals that are used.
Right, but I'm not...
And China has dominated the rare metal field.
Sure, sure. But it's interesting... That's not the next step, actually. The next step is they will actually pull apart the phone and take out the chips within the phones. Those chips have reuse value, not recycling value, but you can actually sell those to be used in other products, and there's a thriving market of that in South China. Then the next step is the precious metals that these contain. And actually, more often than not these days, the precious metals in those phones, the chips that contain them, are actually shipped out of places like India and China to Japan and Belgium, where you have very high-tech recycling facilities that can get the platinum-grade metals out.
I'm assuming the same thing applies to old computers.
Definitely.
What about other appliances? You throw away a printer, or you throw away a broken toaster.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people, unfortunately, throws a lot of this stuff into landfills, which I always countenance people not to do. If it ends up in a recycling facility, it might very well end up in a U.S. e-waste recycling facility. Remember, the U.S. has a very rapidly expanding e-waste industry that does a very nice job with some of this material. The second thing that might happen is it will end up in a Chinese scrapyard, and they'll disassemble it.
And it's likely to wind up in a Chinese village called Guiyu?
Guiyu is primarily mobile phones and PCs, but that is the heart of the global mobile phone and PC recycling industry.
What does that town look like?
It's funny. It's more what does it smell like? Guiyu when you get there, and the smell, I describe it in the book, is this very sweet metallic smell. Maybe that doesn't do it justice. When you drive
through... That would be scary to me.
Yeah, it is. You just know something isn't quite right when you're there. But when you drive through the town, it looks like pretty much any other Chinese small town, and it's actually gotten better. They aren't burning things anymore, so you don't see the black cloud of smoke I used to see over it when I'd arrived, say, 8-9 years ago. What you do see, though, and it's very interesting, is you drive down the street and you'll see there's little huts in front of each of the buildings in the downtown. Those are burn sheds where they actually extract chips from circuit boards.
Has the Chinese government made any effort to regulate this industry?
The Chinese government, Guiyu, is, you know, it's oftentimes depicted as an outlaw town, but in fact, the Chinese government named it its first pilot recycling project for a town, and they actually are trying to reform it, and it's a difficult process, but they've made the choice that if they just shut it down, it's going to go somewhere else in China. So let's keep it where it is and do our best to actually improve it.
Well, are there ways to protect the workers?
Definitely. I mean, it's very simple to just give people respirators and to have ventilation.
Are they wearing them?
Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't.
Well, in addition to recycling, most of our waste, China also, as I said, produces its own share of trash. But what is the percentage of Chinese to the United States and Europe?
We don't know. There simply aren't the statistics. I mean, in a developing country, it's very hard to follow what the trash is. All we know is anecdotally it's growing. For example, we were just talking about Guiyu. If you go to Guiyu and you ask the people down there, they'll say that well over the half of the electronics coming in there, the e-waste, is from China.
Then there's Shijiao.
Shijiao, yes.
What's that town known for?
Well, that I call in the book the Christmas tree light recycling capital of the world, and that's precisely what it is. It recycles, at a minimum, every year, 20 million pounds of American Christmas tree lights.
And how did they do that? I mean, the Christmas tree light is glass. There's the filament in the glass. Then there's plastic. And then there's the wire,
right,
which is covered by some plastic.
Correct. The way you do it is you first shred the Christmas tree light into just very small flakes, pour water on it, and then what you do, what they have are called these vibrating separation tables. And what I ask people to do to imagine how this works is think of a stream bed, and you have rocks on the stream bed with a big current going over it. The small pebbles will move along very quickly. The boulders won't. Well, with a bunch of mulched up Christmas tree lights, the insulation and the glass will move along very quickly if you have water flowing over it, and the copper will stay in one place. So that's essentially how they do it, is they run water over this mulched up process.
And then what happens to the recycled stuff?
Okay, so the copper is sent to brass manufacturers, to copper manufacturers, to be made into new goods, and possibly refined even to higher purity copper. The insulation from the factory that I talk about in this particular piece, chapter at the beginning of the book, it's actually turned into slipper soles.
They make them, what you mean, like slippers?
Right, correct. So they'll actually, the company that actually separates out the rubber doesn't make the slippers themselves, but they'll sell them to companies that actually downgrade the plastic into a low-grade rubber plastic that can be used as a slipper sole.
A listener, Amy from Manhattan, asks this on our show page. How much does the fuel burn to transport recyclables to China and the products that are made from them to other countries offset the ecological advantages of recycling them?
That's a great question. Earlier we were talking about the backhaul. The fact of the matter is, so long as Americans are importing goods from China, there are going to be empty containers going back to China. Those containers are going back one way or another, so why not fill them with recyclables? To my mind, it's in effect sort of a free ticket back because it's going back anyway.
And there'd be a lot more reluctance to send them back empty.
Right, right. I mean, you need to have those filled.
With all of your connections in the scrap trade, both in China and the United States, do you ever think of going back to the family business?
No, absolutely not. It's not for me. I'm not a particularly good businessman. I'm a writer.
Well, the final question has to be, okay, what advice do you give to everyone? What do you offer people who want to reduce the amount of waste that they produce each year?
Right. My advice, it's the advice I give in the book, is, you know, don't necessarily feel that you need to reduce your waste, but instead buy smarter. Buy products that last longer. Buy things that can be reused. When you buy a mobile phone, get one that you can upgrade. Put more memory in. You know, one that you can switch batteries out, not one that you have to throw away when the battery is gone. You know, buy better products. Pressure manufacturers to make better products. If it costs you more, you know, up front, it'll cost you less down the line. They always say, you know, buy cheap. Buy twice. You know, I say buy expensive, buy once.
You have to wonder how much recyclable stuff is in landfills.
Oh, it's incredible. It's a huge amount. And there's actually been a limited amount of landfill mining in the United States. It's not quite economically viable yet. There's some mining of old junkyard landfills, but actual municipal landfills, it's people looking at it very carefully. And there's a belief that as the raw material prices go up, it'll be ready to do it.
What does your family's junkyard look like?
It's actually not a junkyard anymore. It's just a warehouse. So it's been downsized. My father is almost semi-retired at this point.
But we don't see those old junkyards, just a pile of stuff in an open lot as we used to in the past.
Right. Well, most municipalities wouldn't tolerate it.
Adam Minter's book, Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade, is published by Bloomsbury Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.